Donald on the Kitchen talks about food. Donald on the Kitchen talks recipes. Donald on the Kitchen talks about lots of other things on
Community Radio.
Welcome to the Donald on the Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctigal.
And I'm Donna Priskintas.
We gather here once a week to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And we are here at the studios of KHOI Community Radio, and we are in new digs, believe it or not. We are in, like, the state-of-the-art great stuff that can happen when community radio is supported by its community. Thanks to everyone who helped make these new studio facilities available. It's real fun. It is real fun. Well, spring melt, Donna.
Spring has sprung, almost,
yeah,
right?
And we're finding all kinds of things thawing in our yard. It's fun. It's fun.
Soup. It's muddy soup, really.
See, we can complain about the darndest things. Ah, and things are happening at bird feeders. I've been watching mine, but you had some excitement at your bird feeder.
Oh, yeah. We had a Cooper hawk in the yard last week, and it caught another bird, and there were feathers everywhere, and it just sat there and munched the whole thing up. So we got to watch it for about 10 minutes. And then, not 5 days later, there was a sharp shank hawk. It didn't catch anything, so it didn't hang around very long. But they are, you know, when they're at close range in the backyard, they're so magnificent. It was bigger than, or as big as my cat, practically.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think your cat would better tackle that hawk.
I was glad she wasn't outside at the moment. So, yeah.
So things are changing. Animals are moving around. I do believe spring is starting to affect us. That's good. And things will be blooming coming up soon. I have a few.
My irises are peeking out of the ground.
My seedlings haven't started to pop yet, but in the true spirit of being optimistic, I've got quite a few flats started already. So, as someone said once, bring it on, bring it on. Yes. Okay. Today on the Donald on the Kitchen, we are going to consider the apple a true marvel of taste and versatility. We all like a good apple. Joining us at our kitchen table today is a man who knows his way around an orchard. Paul Rash is the owner of Wilson's Orchard near Iowa City. Welcome, Paul.
Well, thanks. Great to be here.
All right, Paul, you are, I expect, a very good raconteur yourself. So do give us a little quick story about how you're from Michigan, so how did you end up in Iowa? And you are our go-to apple man now.
Bit of a roundabout story. Grew up in the apple business in Michigan. Our area of Michigan is West Central, so they call it the Apple Ridge, actually. It's a big, relatively tall ridge that essentially overlooks Lake Michigan and is greatly affected by the climate, the microclimate that is created when the westerly winds blow across Lake Michigan, which in the springtime keeps temperatures relatively cool, thus delaying bloom until the chance of frost has largely passed. And in the winter provides lots of snow and relatively moderate temperatures. It prevents a lot of big swings. It's a big thermal mass, so it prevents the big swings that we get here in Iowa. And that's just made it a very productive, relatively stable fruit-growing region. In my area in Michigan, where I grew up, my dad and his four brothers had 45 kids, good Catholics all, and we worked the various farms together. And, we grew mostly apples, but also peaches, plum prunes. We grew cherries, sweet and tart, and some apricots, but mostly it was an apple business. And then in the winter, we would work basically as slave labor, mostly in the packing houses and, So that was us growing up, and then we had to work from when we were six until we were 16. We started off at 10 cents an hour, and every year we'd get a 5 to 10 cent raise, but they would also put that amount in escrow for us, for college. And so we had to do that till we were 16, and then we were free. So the minute I turned 16, literally, I escaped and went on to try my hand in engineering. And then through complete serendipity, ended up in a program doing village development work in Nepal. And I got put back in the apple business, basically, because that's what they needed. And I discovered I really liked the apple business after all. And that
when you weren't forced to do it, right?
I wasn't forced at that point. Yeah, that was my own free will at that point. So that was kind of the beginning of coming back into the business.
And now you're later, in Iowa, yeah.
So why Iowa after Michigan?
So, well, that's another story. We we were running a very big apple orchard in Michigan. I was the head orchard guy, and to be honest, a little overwhelmed by it. This was a time in the 1990s when the farm crisis of the 80s that affected corn and other row crops started to really affect apples. And a lot of, about 30% of the apple orchards in the United States went out of business, and our orchard suffered quite a bit. And we ended up selling that big orchard. And, well, to make a long story mercifully short, my wife and I moved our two young kids to China, and we started a apple juice company in China, the first commercial apples or first commercial juice business in China. And we were there for 13 years.
Oh, my goodness.
When the kids got ready to kind of getting towards college age, we knew we wanted to come back. And we took a big map of the United States and said, well, we want to be in the Midwest. So we drew a big circle there. And we wanted to be in university town. My wife and I both grew up in small, sort of parochial German towns, as it were, and we didn't want that. We wanted to be in a sort of more diverse mix of people, so we wanted university towns in the Midwest, and every year for about the last 8 years before we left China, we would start to go to the various Midwestern university towns, and Iowa City was the last of them, and this is quite literally true. My wife and I looked at each other after day two and said, this is it. When we were in Iowa City, it just seemed right. Right scale, right area. There happened to be an apple orchard that at the time was for sale. That didn't work out short term, but long term it did. That was Wilson's Orchard. And anyways, that's the story. So that's how we ended up in Iowa City.
Welcome to Iowa. We're glad you're here. Oh, goodness. What a trip. Well, we've got you at our table today because, well, I have lots of questions, but mainly we want to talk about cider.
Yeah, we're, you know, this is the time of year where there's not a lot of local produce, so cider, meat, cheese, things like that, and oh, boy, I have to say, personally, I'm a big cider fan. I mean, I think we're doing really well here in Iowa in terms of beverage production. You know, we've got some good local distilleries, several of them, got a lot of great beer. We're working on the wine thing. It's, you know, it's coming along. But the cider is, it's still my favorite. How are you going to get Iowans to understand cider, Paul? What's the plan?
Well, it's been, so we've been at it about seven, this would be our seventh year.
With the hard ciders.
The hard cider, yep.
Right. Well, first we should make this distinction, because when you say cider in Iowa, of course, everyone's thinking of sweet cider, which we all love, and yours is wonderful. But what I'm excited about is your hard ciders. So when did you introduce those?
So back in 2015, we were working with the first, actually probably the first hard cider company in the upper Midwest was right from this area called Sutliff Cider.
And, very good product. Mm-hmm.
Yes, that fellow Scott Irvin, he is a full-time engineer, and But he did this as a hobby, and he, as it grew, he didn't have enough time to do it all. So eventually we first started selling him apples, then we started selling him pressed sweet cider, unfermented. Then we started fermenting his cider for us after we got an alcohol license to do that. And then we started producing finished product. And at one point I looked at Scott and I said, well, this is crazy. We're doing all the work. You're making all the money. And he laughed, of course, as he is wont to do. And so we basically started producing all of his cider at the same time we launched our own brand of cider at that time. And, you know, so cider, hard cider, and I will differentiate by saying sweet cider for what we refer to as unfiltered, unfermented cider, just apples squished and take the juice. That's sweet cider. I'm going to talk about cider as being hard cider, which is what the rest of the world knows it as. You know, cider has such an interesting history in America and around the world. But the American story is really particularly American in that it really reflects the historical migration of people across the continent. And when they went, they needed clean drinking, clean stuff to drink. And the author Michael Pollan has posited that actually Americans in early days, in the pioneering days, drank more hard cider than water because
it was safer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And they would dilute it down. My dad, when he went to grade school, said that lots of the kids in the community brought hard cider, diluted hard cider, to school with them. That's what they were used to drinking. But our hard cider was really made from just wild apples, essentially.
Is this the Johnny Appleseed story?
It is a bit of that, yeah. Yeah, mm-hmm. Because American pioneers didn't really have a lot in the way of grafted trees. So what they had was open pollinated apples, which meant that, you know, it could have been the progeny of a Golden Delicious and a Jonathan, but it wasn't either of those. It was something in between. It was something just like us that was a blend of our mother and our father. So these open pollinated apples didn't really produce reliably good eating apples. Now people ate them and sometimes they were good. And if they were, they tended to try and preserve that tree. But by and large, most of those apples were for fermentation purposes and after fermentation, you then of course can turn it into cider vinegar, which was also very popular. So the American experience is not like that was in France, Spain, and especially England, mm-hmm. where they were selecting apples specifically for cider production. The American experience was apples, just open pollinated apples, were used to make cider.
Happy accidents. Really,
it was affordable alcohol, basically. You know, that was it.
So a lot of people don't realize this, but the apples that we now eat are not the apples that you make the fermented cider out of. Some of those apples are, well, they're interesting to taste as a flavor note, but they're not eating apples at all. So what are you in your orchard have quite a mix, and I'm so impressed with your growing and testing and grafting program. Okay, Paul has a website about Wilson Orchard, which, you know, you can just Google it and find it, which I did. I spent, it's better than Netflix, folks. I spent 3 hours watching his videos and looking around his website. It's everything you ever wanted to know. So, Paul, give us the quick overview of your apple selection program.
Okay, well, I'll begin by a little bit of a correction in that, in America, in most of the world, what you said is absolutely true. That's apples for making cider are different than apples that are used for eating. What we call eating apples are generally referred to as dessert apples in Europe and France. Mm-hmm. But in America, because the cider tradition died out so abruptly and was always dependent on open pollinated varieties, there has never really been much of a development of apple varieties specifically for making cider. So that is the most interesting and most recent development in our ongoing quest to reclaim cider as an American beverage.
Now it died out because of prohibition, basically. Am I correct?
Yeah, it died out partly because of prohibition was the nail in the coffin that did it in. But urbanization probably did more to kill cider than prohibition, I believe, because cider was always a rural drink. It was, as I said, it was people had, you know, here in Iowa, we were the number six producer of apples in the United States at one point. And almost all of that production was this guy's, you know, side of the farm where he had 2 acres of apples and this family had 3 acres or a half acre or something. And most of those apples were used very, very locally, you know, few to the neighbors, pies, canning, and a lot for cider and vinegar. And that is really what developed as the American sort of source of apples for cider production.
Mm-hmm. So how are you drawing, have some of those genetic lines been stabilized, or are you drawing from European apples? What are you doing for your cider growing apples?
So we do a combination of things. Like pretty much every producer in America draws on dessert apples, you know, the Fuji's, Gala's, Jonathan's, Golden Delicious, very little Red Delicious. They don't make, really Red Delicious is not a variety, even though it's from Iowa, okay, it's really not a very decent variety for much of anything. We use some of the older heirloom varieties from the States. Examples of this would be Roxbury Russet, Golden Russet, Jonathan is a great one for us. Any of the sort of apples that have some kind of distinctive character for cider making, we use those significantly and are grafting a lot of those. So in order to be able to replicate them true to parent, we have to do grafting. You can't depend on growing apples from a seed. Mm-hmm. So we graft over, you know, Roxbury Russet or Golden Russet or Jonathan's or whatever we want. There are some newer varieties that have been developed, one of which we really like is called Gold Rush, which was developed as part of a interesting USDA-led effort that was looking at introducing fungal-resistant apples, disease-resistant apples into America. And some of their later selections, about 30 years on, resulted in this one variety called Gold Rush that we really like for hard cider. So we use a lot of that kind of stuff. But we also have about 5 acres of apples that are specifically for cider production, and those include French and English varieties. So these are, Donna, what you were referring to as the Brits call them spitters, because you taste them, that's all you want to do. They're the combination of bitter and sweet, mostly. There are also bitter sour ones, but most of them are bitter and sweet, and so they're like a bland apple that's bitter to the taste. And they're just not very nice, but you add those into cider, it does three great things. One, it adds to the aroma. Second, it greatly enhances the color. And third, it adds tannins into the picture. And as we all know, you know, this is the difference between a really lame wine and a nice red wine, is that tannic character. And with the addition of tannins, the other thing that happens with ciders is they become eminently storable and they tend to improve with age, whereas most of the ciders made from dessert apples, really it's a cider you want to drink within a year. It's not going to get any better, generally speaking. Yeah. So we do both. The disadvantage, and there are many advantages of these English, French, and now Spanish cider varieties, but the disadvantage is they are a bugger to grow. They're late bloomers, so most of our apples in Iowa will bloom that last week of April to the first week of May, somewhere in that couple, 3 week window. These tend to bloom about 3 to 4 weeks later. And the problem with that scenario is there's a very horrific bacterial disease called fire blight that infects open bloom if the temperature and humidity are correct. And late April, early May, our conditions aren't always very conducive. But if you wait 4 weeks, you have really good conditions for this. So they're very, very susceptible to that disease. They also tend towards biannual bearing, which means they'll set a heavy crop 1 year, none next, heavy crop 1 year, none the next. So they're not what we call grower-friendly trees. We're still sifting through these various varieties. There are some like Dabernay, a French variety, that seem to be pretty good.
They're happier in Iowa than the Dabernay?
Yep, we have Dabernay. That's one of our main French. It depends who you ask. If you ask a Brit, they'll say it's their apple. And if you ask a Frenchman, they'll say it's theirs. But it's an old world apple that has nice tannins. They're kind of soft tannins. And then there's one called a Yarlington Mill that we quite like. And that one is not easy to grow, but it just has such incredible flavor. We love it. I could go on and on. There are also red varieties. And Michigan State University actually has a breeding program now dedicated to developing red cider apples. And these are really interesting. We just made our first rosé cider with some of them, and it's really exceptional. They're red-fleshed apples, basically.
Red-fleshed. Not just tinged with pink, but red.
They're red. There's some white mottled in there, but it's more red than white.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and when you press the juice, it's just a lovely color.
Now,
of course, the American apple, we had wild apples in America, but they were what we now know as crab apples, and there are some of them that are quite nice too. You can make some nice ciders out of them. There's a Russian one called Dolgo that we just love for cider. It's just, but there again, you know, the picking costs and raising costs are quite high, but the cider made from them is exceptional. So we're just kind of in an exciting phase because we planted our cider orchard about 5 years ago, and that is just now coming into full production. So we're just getting enough fruit. This was the first year that we really produced quite a wide variety of different ciders. And this is when the fun commences.
It sounds like it's going to be fun. How lovely. So you have to sort of prepare for some of these trees, even in your test patches or the ones that you count on, sometimes the trees don't always come forth with apples, like you said, biannual production, and so it's catch as catch can. But actually, that sounds like you are open for a lot of wonderful possibilities.
And yeah, I mean, it's
variations.
On a good level, you would say they're wonderful possibilities. Sometimes they're just dreadful outcomes. You know, we're pretty good at making mistakes ourselves, and the weather can really play havoc with us. We've had 2012, we had a complete crop loss on 50 acres of apples. We produced way less than 1,000 pounds, which was basically fruit from about four trees. This is a very challenging climate. Iowa used to be the number six producer of apples, and by the way, in the top 10 of a lot of horticultural crops in the U.S. at that point. We've lost a lot of that diversity, and I'm hoping we can get it back. But the point is that in Armistice Day, there was a huge freeze that effectively wiped out the entire Iowa apple industry. It killed trees right to the ground. If the industry was strong at that point, that would probably have led to a lot of replanting of newer varieties and things, but it basically just ended it because, like I said, Most of these were just add-on, maybe slight enterprises for family farms. But farms had by that time moved very strongly into corn and soybeans and things, and apples weren't a big part of the equation anymore. So we kind of lost it there. But yeah, apple growing in this upper Midwest is, can be very challenging. I'd say coming from Michigan, it's amazing just how adverse conditions can be. From the biggest thing is not the extreme colds we get or the hottest days we get. It's the fluctuation that we get, especially in the fall and the spring, where you get, you know, all of a sudden, an 85 degree day in October turns into a 5 degree day 3 days later or something. You know, this is really hard on trees, especially trees that are essentially anymore kind of like thoroughbred racehorses. They're just, they can't handle the conditions like probably wild apples could at one point.
Yes, that sounds like it's a big challenge. We're going to
risk.
We're going to talk more to Paul Rash. We're going to take a little break here. I want to remind folks, this is KHOI Community Radio, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen, Tasty Radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen. We're talking to Paul Rash from Wilson's Orchard near Iowa City, and he's talking about how and why and apples. And we'd like to talk to you more about making cider, tasting cider, and what kinds. My goodness, have at it, Donna.
Well, I wanted to ask about, I have three of his, I don't know, he must have six or eight hard ciders now, right, at least?
Oh, yeah, way more than that. Yeah,
more than
probably
that.
Have 15, maybe. They kind of come and go.
Yeah, I think Lana and I are going to have a road trip over and visit your whole setup. It just looks fabulous. So anyway, here I have tasted your wild ferment and your oaked aged. The wild ferment, I loved it. It's the first one I tried. It is available in Ames and also, I think, Des Moines, Cedar Rapids, Iowa City. You can have this beverage. The wild ferment means you're using no yeasts, right?
We're using only wild yeast.
Yeah.
So this is yeast that's essentially, so our production facility for our cider is located right, I mean, it just right there, almost right in the orchard. It's right next to the orchard, on the edge of the orchard. So the yeast from the orchard gets in everything and it comes in on the apples. And so we do, if we're using an external yeast, a commercial yeast, which we do use for some products, we will put sulfur in to basically shock the system a bit and retard those wild yeasts so that these hybrid commercial yeasts can take off and do their thing. But in this one, we just let the cider be the cider and let the yeast do their thing. Wild yeast do not... they're not hybrids. They're not, I shouldn't say hybrids. They're not bred, you know, to be one thing or another. Some yeasts are bred to be better at, you know, not having spoilage organisms or imparting certain flavors or bringing out certain natural characters of wine grapes or apples or whatever. These wild yeasts haven't been selected for anything, but what they are is they are incredibly diverse. So it's not like one yeast. You know, this could be, we've never done any assay of it, but probably there's 30 to 100 strains of different fungal organisms in there.
And is it different every year than the yeasts, or are they consistent because of the geography?
They tend to kind of develop their own little ecosystem and be relatively stable. Yeah. And well, so each of those yeasts can contribute different things. So the reason most wine or cider producers may not want, or even beer now, may not want that, is the results can be a little bit unpredictable. Maybe this strain imparts a certain flavor, and maybe this year they're ascendant and they're a little bit stronger because of weather or whatever. So it's a little bit less predictable, but we kind of like that. I mean, living on the wild side is kind of fun. We all know that. So this wild ferment combines wild yeast with some of our earliest vintages of our European cider apples. This one.
Oh, is that why? Because when I tasted it, it's like, it tastes just like the good apple ciders from Brittany in France. It really has that very European, or at least the French kind of flavor. I love it. It's fabulous, Paul.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it's a real crowd pleaser here. We don't have that huge a volume of it yet, because we're this each year now we'll have more and more of those varieties. We've had to kind of commandeer more and more of it for our own staff, because there was a lot of unhappiness with the fact that we sent it all out to the stores and there wasn't enough to
grow more. Right.
Right.
Well, the other one I tasted is your oak. Now, I have to say, these all come in cans. That's what you're doing for your retail sales, right?
Yes. Going to change. We are going back. We did some bottles. Early on, we were completely in glass bottles. And me being an old fuddy-duddy, I believe that was the epitome of quality, was in glass. But I was overruled, and it turns out I was wrong. And, you know, it's a good package. You know, aluminum cans, to me, they always seem like that's what you put beer in or something. Mm-hmm. But they are very... they exclude oxygen very well, which is a real enemy of good cider. And that is what we do. So we have basically, we're going to be putting out a new line of ciders very soon in wine bottles. And these will be very limited quantities. They will tend to reflect very specific varieties or some very specific blends of varieties, and so those will be coming out. But right now we produce our main line of products, where we have a Honeycrisp cider that's just an easy drinking everyday kind of cider. We have a cherry variant, which is using Michigan Montmorency cherries. We have a blueberry variant, which again uses Michigan fruit, and then we have a peach one, which also uses Michigan fruit. I'm kind of fond of Michigan fruit, especially as we can't grow it here. And so those are kind of the mainstays of our production, and those are in 12-ounce cans. And now we have this, what you're referring to, we call them our seasonals, and every year we'll be producing more of them. Those will be in 16-ounce cans, and that wild ferment is one. There's going to be an oak variant as one. There's another one called Kveik, which is referring to a Scandinavian yeast that ferments very fast, very quick, and produces some really unusual, very, very fruity flavor notes, and then a rosé as well. So those are all in 16-ounce cans and will be sort of hit and miss. They're going to be seasonal, so we'll do 3 months of a wild ferment. When that's gone, we'll launch into an oak, and then, you know, the Kveik and the rosé will follow.
Well, tell me how you started doing the oak-aged one. When I drank that one, I thought it's lighter than the wild ferment. It's almost, I hate to say wine-like because it's not really like wine. It's definitely a cider, but it has some levity to it that you think would, oh, this would work really well in food pairings especially or something. What brought about that oak-aged one, and what's going on? What does the oak do to the apple cider?
Well, it's interesting. So there's a tradition even in Europe of at least fermenting in oak. We were just in Spain just before COVID, and there they used big chestnut barrels. Everything is fermented and aged in them. Wood in particular just seems like a natural fit with cider. Some of the tannins, some of the sort of slightly bitter notes that you get from wood, especially as it mellows, just blends super, super well with the base flavor of a good cider. It greatly affects the clarity of the cider as well. Things, you know, all the dead yeast cells and stuff drop out.
Oh yeah, it's really pretty in the glass.
Yeah. It's really phenomenal. And then and I mean what we've come to see is that there's different ways of using oak. It's there's different oaks, of course, and they have different effects, but also what temperature you use it at, how long you put it in, how long you age it after you take the oak out, all of that affects the flavor. And that oak product in particular is one that when you taste it, you know, just after the oaks come out, it's one product, and it can be very oaky at that point. But then you give it a couple of weeks, you go back and it's all vanilla. And then you go back a couple of weeks and a little bit of that oakiness is returned, but there's still the vanilla. And now you're getting some other subtle hints of other sort of herbal-like tones. It's just an amazing product that changes a lot. We just had a can that I found that was over a year old, and I tasted it expecting one thing, and I was just flabbergasted. It tasted just completely different than what I expected or remembered it being.
So it goes on changing even when it's in the can?
Yes. Yeah, wow. Those flavors, you know, mellow and change very subtly, and oak in particular seems to have that effect. But having said that, the tannin apples as well, the cider varieties, we find that they also lend themselves towards aging, although it's much more predictable in my feeling. You know, you can kind of expect what's going to happen to that cider 6 months down the road.
Well, how long do you age it before you put it in the cans, sort of, or how do you decide, for goodness sake?
All of our ciders are at least a month to 2 months, but a lot of these seasonal ciders will be more like 2 to 4 months, something like that. It really depends. The oak one ages the longest because we want to get a certain flavor profile from that product before we release it.
Very good. So you said the production of your ciders happens real close to the trees where they all start. And you also have a way of dealing with what is left of the apple cider making process. Tell us how you use your sheep.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm going to back up just a minute and talk about probably our biggest challenge. Is I grew up in the orchard industry where every bug was a bad bug, and every disease, everything that we didn't want to eat had to be bad. So we sprayed a lot. We killed a lot of things. And in the process, we made a lot of mess for ourselves and for the environment that we're trying to grow things in. So one of the biggest challenges we face is how to get back to some kind of a balance. And, you know, sustainability to me is kind of a catch-all word that doesn't mean anything anymore. But our, you know, as a fruit farmer in the upper Midwest, it is a real challenge to build a regenerative, sustainable, call it what you will, farm. And one of the things that we decided early on is that we wanted to close loops, nutrient loops, wherever possible. And the second is we wanted to build soils because we felt those two fundamental building blocks would help us a lot. So towards the latter, we started messing around with Katahdin sheep some years ago. We started off with pigs. We were looking for something to take the what we call the apple pumice. So after you take apples, wash them, grind them, squeeze them, you're left with pumice, which has pretty reasonable feed value, actually, similar almost to corn, a little lower protein value, but pretty good carbohydrate value. And we tried pigs, and we found having stomachs like us, humans, they played with it more than ate it. And plus pigs, as much as I like them, they kept getting out and causing trouble. So we went to sheep, and we've been in love with Katahdin sheep ever since. Katahdins are a type of hair sheep, as you'll know. And so we take the pumice, and then, you know, during our busy season, we're producing something between 8 and 10,000 pounds a week of this stuff. And we basically have some 45 acres of pasture, and we feed the sheep on grass and pumice during much of the year. Now, this time of the year, the cider's all been made, and the sheep are eating hay. There's no pumice to be found, but I tell you, when you go into the, when the sheep first hear the tractor coming with that pumice trailer, they crowd the gates and literally stampede it. They love it. They eat it like ice cream.
How do you keep it from fermenting and getting the sheep drunk?
Well, they eat it fast. I mean, we spread it every day after it's pressed. So
eat the whole thing.
I mean, on a hot day, whatever doesn't get eaten will start to ferment. You can smell it a little bit, but by and large, very little of it gets that far.
So it sounds like you live in the land of happy sheep. We'll take another quick break here and come back for more. This is KHOR. You're listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. Find out more at khoyfm.org. Welcome back. We're talking to Paul Rash from Wilson's Orchard. We're talking cider. It's so wonderful to have such an exciting product right here in the middle of Iowa. And I know you had a long trip to get here, and I'm awfully glad you got here. That's great. That's great.
Well, I also want to say, from having perused the website, it looks like someplace we're going to have to make a road trip to. Paul, I think you're a man with, as my mother would say, a frog in every pocket. You've got some restaurants, a bakery, a smokehouse, a general store. You got so much going on over there. Tell us a little bit. A big event venue with a reconstructed barn. It looks gorgeous. So much.
Yeah. Everything but time is what we have.
You can plant some of that, okay?
Well, when we moved here, we couldn't buy Wilson's Orchard, and so we bought a separate farm and planted an orchard, and then, as fate has it often, the Wilsons, they were getting on in their years, and one of the owners had a heart attack, and then they really wanted to sell. So we ended up with two orchards that way. Wilson's Orchard is just 2 miles north of Iowa City, and that's our kind of public face. So we have a reconstructed barn, as you said. It's a 10,000 square feet upstairs, full-on farm-to-table restaurant. Downstairs, it's a wedding and event venue. And we do all the food, everything. I would say we are really preeminently drawn towards local everything that we can, whether it's proteins like meat and tofu or vegetables or, of course, our own fruit and things. We really try to take a great deal of care in that. Then, of course, we do the whole U-Pick orchard thing, and we've kind of expanded that. We used to be open 3 months a year. Now we're open year-round, and that starts with tulips, U-Pick tulips in late April and May. And then we go into strawberries, and then raspberries, blueberries, sunflowers. We're doing sweet corn, melons, and then we get into apples, of course, and then pumpkins. And then we catch our breath and do it all again. So, yeah, we do have a lot going on. And then at the farm that we, my wife and I and our kids started with when we came back, that's just 7 miles away near Solon. That one's not open to the public. But that's where we grow a second orchard, and we do a lot of wholesale apples out of there for Hy-Vees and the university and the school district. And that's where we make the cider. So that's kind of us. That's where we also raise the sheep. This year we're also going to start raising a few pigs. We're going to try that again, and some chickens. Just to start to, again, close those nutrient loops and recycle as much as we can of our, say, bakery waste and other things are going to go back into them. And, yeah, so it's an ongoing quest. It's quite an interesting one. Our two kids are both back in the business now, and that's a great help. But they also are joined by quite a talented team of folks. Our main chef is quite well known in Iowa, frequent semifinalist for James Beard Award, and one of the real early advocates and implementers of the farm to table stuff. Yeah, we feel like there's certainly a strong tailwind right now for local foods, and we believe very strongly that it's an important thing, not just for our nutrition, but also for our economies. And we want to do everything we can to support it. And at the same time, we want to make a thriving business that shows to a certain extent that you don't have to have 3,000 acres of corn and beans to be a successful farm operation in Iowa.
How has your restaurant and food service aspects of, how has that been impacted by COVID?
Yeah, I mean, it's been, you know, we have a fairly diverse business with essentially with three main legs. You know, we have the wholesale business. We have the retail, we call the retail farm business, which is U-Pick and the bakery and things. And then we have the whole food service, which is events and restaurants. And honestly, that third leg has just been devastated the last couple of years, as has everyone's, you know.
Yeah.
We're not unique in that, and we can't cry any more than anybody else. The one thing is that by having diversity, the other two legs have kept us going in pretty good shape. So we've been fortunate that way. But diversity helps ecologically. It also helps economically, we've come to see.
So you're going to be able to resume the restaurant then, basically.
Oh yeah, it's going again. The events have been a little bit more halting. The event business for us has been really surprisingly good up until COVID, but it's also been extremely hard because, of course, you know, the early days of COVID, everything shut down, and then there were hopes that once we vaccinated, everything would get back to normal, and then there was setbacks, and so. You know, some people are literally on their fourth rebooking of their wedding, and it's just starting to wear people out. So we haven't had anything much to do in events. Now that's going to start to crank up now, it looks like. But that's been a real.
Well, and you guys are prepared to do out of doors business too there, aren't you, basically?
Yes, we do a lot about outdoors. We have a casual smokehouse restaurant that is completely out of door. You know, it's just, you come to it's a separate building. You get your food. We've got picnic tables everywhere. We've got music and stuff like that. We're doing a lot of that stuff. This year we started an ice rink as well, which has been quite fun.
Oh, good, good. It sounds like you have a lot of, besides a lot of challenges, it sounds like you have a lot of joy in your businesses, in your business too. That's great. For those of you, for those of us who want to find out more about you, how do we get in touch with you? How do we find you?
Yeah, so wilsonsorchard.com, it's kind of our home base. I mean, you can go on Facebook and Instagram and all that stuff. I'm not the person to ask about that. I think if you did Wilson's Orchard in Facebook, you'd find something. Probably the same is true in Instagram. I'm just a bit too old to care about that. but yeah, that's the best way to get a hold of us. We're just a couple of miles north of Iowa City. If you come to Iowa City, there's signs on the highway. And of course, Mother Google can take anybody anywhere anymore. So that'll get you there as well.
And when does the tulip picking begin? Sort of, can you guess?
Yeah, usually it's that last week of April. Mm. So this year we planted 60,000 bulbs. It's our biggest planting ever.
Oh my God.
So it should be quite a show. It's quite fun because, you know, you just want to get outside so much. And then you have this warm days and a burst of color. It just feels good to be human.
And of course your restaurants and the cidery and all of that will be open, so you can pick tulips,
right,
and have a meal, right?
Yeah, we do have a little bit of unusual hours in that we're open Wednesday through Sunday from 10 till 8, but we're closed Mondays and Tuesdays. That's the thing that most people can't often get their head around. We're closed Mondays and Tuesdays, but the other days it's
on. We can deal with that. Thank you for being with us today, Paul. This was fantastic. And Donna, I'm looking forward to open up some.
Thanks for the cider. We are really enjoying. I mean,
good.
I can, you know, cider is my favorite alcoholic beverage. So thank you for doing such a good job. And I hope more Iowans can learn to love what you're doing. It's, you know, it's delicious.
Like you said, it's a very human thing to do. Thank you for being with us, Paul. Good.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's been just a great joy and love hearing what you guys are up to. It's great stuff.
Good. You've been listening to the Donna Lana Kitchen. We come to you live every Tuesday at noon, repeated 7 p.m. on KHOI Community Radio. My name is Lana Noctico.
And I'm Donna Prisgintas.
Eat good food and enjoy life. We've had engineering by Mike Murphy. Eat good food and enjoy life. Yes.